I think that now some of you start feeling, oh, I have a question, I would like to put it forward, and you will soon get the chance. My colleagues here will have microphones, so just prepare yourself. But I'd like to send a question first to the panel, and that's, we've now heard a lot about different ways of working, and seems like a lot of things could be good in promoting governance and also in addressing corruption. So the matter is, what should we focus on? And also the time perspective I'd like to raise, because some of the institutional changes that you highlighted, Borotsen and Marcus, they take time, really, to set up a tax system that works and also universal education, gender equality, and so forth. What can donors do in the short run? And how should we think when, for instance, we see a very promising new president in a country really saying it will not be business as usual? What can donors do to support in the short run, in the long run? And if there is no president who says that there will be say it will be business as usual, even though the person is not saying it, should donors act differently? So I'll let you think about them, and then I think we open the floor so that we could add a few questions. And I will say, please say your name, affiliation, and be very brief, otherwise I will interrupt you. So please go ahead.
Thank you. My name is Per Nordlund. I'm lead policy specialist at SIDA for Democracy and Human Rights. And we are, of course, very glad that Eva has taken this initiative. And we're also very grateful for the hard work by Quality of Government Institute to supply this report and all the research that lies behind it, because this is a huge undertaking. So it provides evidence which is really important for us in our work. Some of us in the room, Marlon, one over here, is responsible for what we call the crocodile gap, which were the two graphs going like this. One, that the flat line being basically then the within the democracy and human rights portfolio, support to institutions being flat, and then a steady increase in the support to civil society actors, basically. We are, of course, taking a step further and looking at those figures, and it looks a little bit different depending on how you interpret it, but basically it's there. And the reason is, of course, political. Through the strategies, there's been a focus on actors. We also have much fewer countries where we have budget support, which is another example of this. So that's the explanation of that. But it's a very good point of departure for having this discussion. Three things and one question. First, yes, policy coherence is absolutely crucial. There's only so much we can do with aid. It has to be a whole-of-government approach. We worked on this since 2003. I know there's a revival of this initiative. I think this is crucial for addressing corruption across and governance issues. Second, within the democracy and human rights portfolio, what we can do, for example, at SIDA, when we think about these things, before we had the problem of governance being everything that is good, we had this debate. This is really helpful. It helped us sharpen our thinking in terms of what are the things that we need to focus on. We can't do everything. So is it meritocracy? Is it taxation, for example? Should we work more with that? And should we? And then how should we do with that? And then the third is really that this has to be throughout our operations, yes. But we now have an SDG 16, which is on effective, inclusive, and accountable institutions. It's really about how we do this throughout all the work we do. For example, when we do health, when we do education, what are the things that we bring with us into those sector programs in terms of addressing governance and corruption, is it? And it has to do with meritocracy, for example. But gender integration at SIDA is around 90%. We do a lot on that. Human rights-based integration at SIDA is very high. Non-discrimination is a key principle there. That goes to impartiality. There are good things being done. I'm not saying we're doing this already, but I'm saying this helps us focus. This helps us understand what are the things that Sweden and SIDA should do in this. But in order to do that, and that's the question, and you said
now the question, yes, please.
But to address this, What are the mechanisms when you do, for example, meritocracy? How do you get to that? Because we know that the patronage system is the basis for this. We know that a political settlement in Afghanistan or a newly democratized country moving into multi-party system, this is part of the settlement. This is not something that is sort of independent, exactly like you said. This is part of the sort of underlying basic norm or the agreement in society. So how do you start to change that? Because then things will change as you go along.
Thank
that
you,
That is Per. Why we need more research.
Now I will interrupt you. Here we have someone else up. And
my name is Bertil Odén. I will be shorter. Starting with the five institutional devices that you have presented in your report, taxation, meritocracy, universal education, gender equality, and good auditing. Which of those would you say are possible to affect from the outside, and what shall a donor agency do when what is in the donor agency lingo is called ownership, when that is lacking in a country in which you are working? How I would be interested in hearing you elaborating a bit on this issue, which is what aid donors always are running into. I would also ask for a more technical question, and that is, in the figure 10, you have this impartial public administration, and I would be interested in what indicators are in, or what type of indicators are included in that. And I would also be interested to hear the other countries, except apart from Estonia, that were you mentioned that there were seven countries and five of them have made significant progress. Could you mention the other ones? Thank you.
Thank you, Bertil. Let me see. Are there... Yes, up there. And now I really urge you, you were not a good example. You took too much time, so please speed up the questions.
Okay. My name is David Montgomery. I work for Sweco, a consulting company. I've been working for other international consulting companies before. I've been working with internationally aid finance project for 30 years. I've seen on the field level corruption increase tremendously during these 30 years. It didn't exist before, and today it's all over. And in particular after 2005, the Paris Agenda, where this ownership policy was implemented, and including procurement. It is very bad. It is actually as bad that our company, the company I work for, they're not interested in working for aid finance project because it's too risky for our CSR policies, which is a paradox in itself. Okay. So in our consulting association, we have said that corruption is our enemy, number one, by far. We have had meetings with SIDA and Minister of Foreign Affairs a number of times during the last 10 years. We don't think they have taken it seriously enough. They have policies, I know that, but they don't implement the policies. We see this; they're still feeding money into the procurement machinery in the World Bank and others, and it's the same business as usual.
Okay. And, do you have a question as well? Do you have a question as well?
Yes, my question is about opportunities, that the aid has served too many opportunities, and we have also offered some advice to SIDA how it should be adjusted, that the financier, the donor, take more action in the procurement process itself.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
And then we have one up there. Two very brief questions, and then we will also let the panel answer, because now we already have a number of of interesting topics. So please.
Thank you. I'll try to be brief. I'm Karin Metel-Cueva from SIDA's Africa Department, and I also think this was a very interesting report and an interesting discussion. But I have a question for Borotstein. When you point out the five institutional devices that comes as a recommendation, you first pinpoint that the principal agent theory doesn't work, and I think a lot of us feel that that's really the case, that we haven't believed in it, and that this is a problem of collective action. But as Professor Alina pointed out, problems of collective action are the hardest one to get to. How do you get to them? And what I failed to understand here is how these five institutional devices correlate to these, to solving a collective action. Isn't there actually a problem that we try to look at what's missing ingredient instead of trying to look at how we work? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I'll also try to be brief. My name is Catalina Uribe. I'm from International IDEA, the Institute for Democracy and Electoral Assistance. I have a few, but for the presenter's sake, I'll just prioritize. In line with that, I was wondering how these five institutions correlate or have a causal effect into the decrease of corruption or the increase of good governance. And I was wondering about the sources of corruption, because it's very different when someone mentioned organized crime and other sources of corruption. So how these five institutions respond to those different types of sources of corruption, that those, if those matter. And finally, you mentioned, because we are an institute that works on democracy, so this sort of separation between democracy and state capacity seemed just very odd to me, because, I mean, except if you take a very old approach to to democracy, basically state capacity is at the core of democracy or the quality of democracy. So I guess coming from, depending on the definition, but to what extent do you separate these two notions into then delivering what, well, fighting corruption or increasing good governance means? So,
thank you. I know that the person responsible for corruption issues at SIDA also wants to put forward questions, and I think you will be very brief, won't you? Yes, please. And this will be the last question for the...
Yes, question. Thank you also for excellent presentations and very interesting discussion. My name is Molly Lien from SIDA. I just wanted to ask Alina Mondiu-Pipidi about the five or seven achievers that you mentioned. Have any of them been able to do this without a strong political will from the top government? Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. I won't promise that there will be any further chances here today to put forward questions, but possibly after the seminar, I think some of them would stay. So here we have a number of questions now regarding the five institutional devices. Are they possible to affect from the outside? And how do we get to meritocracy? And then we also ask about when there is beneficial conditions, political leaders with an interest, and when there are not, how to act, and also the time perspective. So, and there were some other issues that I think are more directed to some of you. You will get some 2 minutes each, and who would like to start? It's not possible, I know. Nils will start. Thank you.
I can start because I'm not the author of the study, so most of the questions are not for me. I think an important question you asked is, what do you do in a country where there is where there is promise for reform? And I think one of the things you do is not focus on quick wins, because that's one of the traps that we fall into, and that's when we go into the enforcement field and we want to put people in prison and so on. I think it's really about following the lead of that government and supporting that government or that leader in their reform agenda. So providing them the resources, the backing, and the support to see it through, because any corruption reformer will inevitably meet resistance within their system. So how can donors help that actor to stay the course? I think also just one of the problems that we have in these discussions is that we say that corruption is a failure of government, but I think corruption is a failure of a welfare state to deliver to its people. But I think corruption could be an extremely effective form of government if your goal in a small elite is to maintain power and to distribute wealth and maintain the status quo. So I think we also have to understand that, and that is then the issue: what should donors do in places where there's less chance of success? Well, maybe they should then choose not to engage in those countries. Maybe we need to think more carefully about where we engage and where we don't. But then you have the dilemma that the countries that have the highest chance of succeeding may be the ones who need aid the least. So that's sort of, there's always the flip side to however we see it.
Okay, Alina?
Okay, I had a list of 9 questions, but I'll be very brief, which is an outline of how these 7 countries, which again are Costa Rica, Uruguay, Chile, Taiwan, South Korea, Estonia, and Georgia, you can find in my Cambridge University Press book, which was alluded to, The Quest for Good Governance, which has just been out, so exists in electronic version, so it can be checked. I'll also put out a policy report in February for the European Commission with lessons from these countries. And yes, lesson number one, clearly, is the fact that we cannot solve problems in development by taking a part of the problem and presenting it as a solution. Meritocracy, for instance, is a goal that we aspire to. It's not something that we can presume it will be a solution to our problems. They do not have meritocratic recruitment for a reason. If a country doesn't have meritocratic recruitment in government, you have to look around. I mean, if you want to do something in that country, and by the way, if it's such a country, you should not do your procurement through the country's host institutions, but organize it separately. That is preliminary advice, right? But let's say you really are there to invest for the long term, as you ask. I mean, because this is long-term investment to change governance of a country. So what do you do? Government definitely doesn't have any will, because they would have any will. They would already give you some sign. They would reorganize government. They would create some evaluation department for staff, and then they would ask you in to provide training, not the other way around, okay? And therefore, I would not work on that government at all. I would look around and ask myself, are there some islands of meritocracy in the society? For instance, are public universities meritocratic, or they also work by patronage? In Ukraine, for instance, universities, public universities, are entirely corrupt. But fortunately, in the last 10 years, I've seen a couple of private universities developing. So maybe this is a good investment, because in the end of the day, nobody will hire if you create a counterweight. Nobody will hire, you know, somebody with a diploma from corrupt universities where there is absolutely no coverage in skills. You only sell a diploma to students. This is how corrupt universities work. So find anything which works meritocratically and support the development of this. Otherwise, if patronage is the rule and not merit in the whole society, there is completely unrealistic to imagine that only the government which has the highest discretion, will lead the way into doing meritocratic recruitment, right?
Thank you so much. I think I will wait with you, Ulrika. You will get the last word today. And I will hand over to Rothstein. Most of the questions were directed to you, so please pick and choose the ones you want to answer.
I think one of the most important lessons from our 10 years of research is this universal understanding of corruption. It means that donor organizations don't have to go to highly corrupt countries and say, your ethic is wrong, you are bad people, you internalize corruption, because they don't. That is what we show, both from ethnographic research and from survey research. People in hopelessly corrupt settings do not internalize corruption as something okay. It's not in their culture. So we don't have to go there and say, it's your culture is wrong. We have to go there and say, you're okay, you just happen to live under 40 institutions. These can be changed. Nobody said it was easy. But that is a major step. Now, if it is the case that most people realize that this is a bad equilibrium, this is a bad situation, they are willing to change. If something can convince them that most other agents in their situation is also willing to change. This is the same thing that we have. It's meaningless to be the only one in the city that sorts your garbage if you don't think that other people are doing it, right? So this is a very sort of clear problem. Now, we point at these five institutional devices because they all send signals about impartiality, which is a very new game in town. We have to realize that we are the exception. 70% of the world's population live under either completely or almost completely corrupt institutions. Now, if this is the case, nobody said it was easy to change this. If it was easy to change, we would have fixed the problem long ago. However, these institutional devices are not the complete set. Other people can come up with new ideas. These are the ones we have found, and our colleagues have found, quite clear empirical support for. They have an effect. Now, just take, of course we can change meritocracy. If we can send people to developing countries, helping them to organize free and fair elections, we could send people who evaluate people who apply for positions in the public services. If we can have a system known as Doctors Without Borders, we could have a system known as Teachers Without Borders. Transferring norms. One thing that seems to work quite well, and this is from this study of auditing system, is norms are transferred if people in developing countries participate in international conferences and so on where these norms are established. So we can transfer norms about what is good tax administration, what is good auditing. And of course, you know, most countries have forever and ever discriminated women in the public sector. And if a country that have done this suddenly says, okay, we will maybe not reach perfect gender equality in our lifetime. Very few countries do. But from now on, it's not acceptable, and people who don't live up to actually following gender equality principles in recruiting and promoting women in the public sector, that is not acceptable. I think that will have a change. And I'm not so... It's easy to become pessimistic in this business, I can tell you. But think about, we're trying now to relate corruption to human rights, and we don't think it's so far-fetched. I mean, not having to pay bribes to get health care is not so far away from a human rights situation. Now, think about the Declaration of Human Rights. It came in 1948. Nobody paid attention for 30 years. It was just a piece of paper. And then suddenly people in many countries started to pay attention. When the Soviet leaders signed the Helsinki Declaration, they didn't understand they were signing the death sentence, right? Now, in a number of years ago, we have this United Nations Declaration against Corruption. It's very unknown. People don't know about it. But what is it, Alina? Some 160 countries have signed it. It's not so far-fetched that in a number of years people will start taking this as seriously as they took human rights and will actually hold their people responsible. Mind you that the Arab Spring, even if it hasn't delivered, actually started with a corruption issue. It did. These institutional devices, nobody said it was easy, but I cannot really figure out why it wouldn't work, why we couldn't put much more money into helping, educating, strengthening the public administration and state capacity in these countries. Of course, this has to go from agency to agency, and I know that this is done, and that seems to work. Mm-hmm. But as you could see, it's actually a fraction of the money. Now, I'm not against civil society. I think civil society is great. But unfortunately, the evidence for support for civil society for solving this problem is not there. The expert group had a report, I think a year ago, about the civil society, and it landed in an interesting conclusion that Swedish international aid should have a balanced approach, I quote it, a balanced approach to civil society. And I was thinking, what would be the opposite? Had we actually have an unbalanced approach to civil society? I'm very sorry, but, you know, the evidence that civil society as such is good for democracy of human development, we cannot find it.
Okay. Thank you so much. I think we've had almost 2 hours now. We've started by the misunderstanding and also the need for a better conceptual understanding. And then we've come towards more and more concrete interventions. And I think very good, Bo, towards the end, you got very concrete without teachers, without borders, and other examples of how donors could act and what to do. And now the final question to you, Ulrika Modéer. What are the main issues that you will bring back from this seminar? I just give you a few minutes to summarize the main findings that you would like to highlight when you come back to your office.
Thank you. And thank you for the possibility not to only get knowledge, but also inspiration to work on this. I think that there are several issues, and given my background working in civil society, I have to agree that I think that sometimes we have given too much emphasis on civil society, because of many of the problems or challenges that we see with regard to corruption and not enough meritocracy. I mean, you could also find these kind of political culture, of course, within the civil society organizations in the same country. But I would like to bring back what Elina has been saying about tracing progress. And you were saying that we can find islands, perhaps not of excellence, but islands of good experience that we could work from. And I've myself had this experience with me also now in office. I mean, we have seen that there are good working institutions at the local level. Why would not see it at the central level in some countries? I mean, that, of course, has to be and is being supported by Swedish Development Corporation. We can see drivers of change, of course, then also within civil society and at the national level. And with regard to what's happening globally, also with the new SDGs, I think it's very, very important that we not see this. And when we look at these studies, not only look into the field of what do we do then within this budget line of SIDA working on democracy, but we need to see the importance of working this throughout the whole aid system and also within the work we do with the SDGs. I think that it was not mentioned, perhaps I was about to ask after you had mentioned what has not been done in the right way within development cooperation. The past years we've had a lot of these development of the word vertical funds and the MDGs that have served us well, I think also in politics to drive our ambitions with regard to development. But we also know that there has been a lot of cherry picking and donors wanting to work with a certain goal and creating new vertical funds for this, where we have not worked perhaps enough with the institution building, but focused quite a lot. And I think the British aid agency has been quite good at doing that as well, creating sure. vertical funds. Yeah. So this is something I think we need to look at. And also, I think that, I mean, it was said that we have a whole of government approach with based on the decision taking in Parliament already back in 2003. And Ardalan Shekarabi is actually now this week traveling to work on the area of procurement, because we have also in meetings with you, I believe, been saying that we need to look at this much more. And of course then working with the multilateral system, but I mean, how should we then strengthen the local system if we don't believe in the possibility to also strengthen the ability and the capability to work on procurement at the national level? So I think that this should also be part of the agenda that we work with regard to your question.
Thank you very much. And I think the concrete, possibly more concrete details, we'll see in the policy framework that is to be finalized in May, June or so. So that will be interesting to see the possible implications of the discussion today. And before we finalize, I'd like to hand over to Lars Heikensten. And while he's entering the stage, please give them a warm applause.
Well, thank you. I do now and then try to summarize these seminars, and that's never an easy task. I should start by saying that I think that this report in many ways is a good example of the kind of report we would like to have in the expert group. And I say that because some of you might be potential authors of reports. It draws on theory and it draws on empirical studies, and it ends up in fairly clear suggestions and ideas of what one can do, and that has also been reflected, I think, in the discussion here, that the discussion has also been a meaningful and rather clear discussion. The conclusion I draw from the discussion is the one that several of you have already drawn, that it seems reasonable to use more of Swedish aid to quality of government work. And it does. So it is, of course, interesting to see that graph and reflect what were the motivations for that, the ones that were actually given and those that might be behind it. I don't know, but I think that's in itself an interesting issue. Another conclusion seems to be that there are strong reasons to try to do several things at the same time, if possible. And that I assume will be difficult in many countries. But someone said, you know, you have to choose. Well, not necessarily so. One could perhaps do all the five areas, for example, that Bo pointed out. But one cannot do that in all countries, obviously. But that doesn't seem to be much of a problem, because there will not be that many countries where it would perhaps make sense to do this overall thing at the same time. But there might be some countries where one can do that. And if one cannot do that, well, then Alina suggested that one would need to find other routes, and Ulrika pointed out that in some countries you could go via local governments, or you could find and do some meaningful thing, even if it would not be the sort of the big bang approach on things. It's fine, I think, that you managed to point out areas, and it so happens that many of those areas actually are areas where Sweden has a fairly good competence. But Alina also, I think you were the one who underlined most clearly that it's not only a matter of dealing with these particular areas, but it's also a matter of how the basic structure is. I mean, we all know that the way economic policies are designed gives very different room for corruption. So if you have, like they have in India, for example, a very regulated system in many areas, well, then you will have more corruption in the end.
Don't worry about that.
I'm not necessarily saying that, you know, that it applies everywhere. There might be areas, surely, there where more regulation might be needed. But generally speaking, this I think, is a clear conclusion. So there are reasons to think through the overall structure in terms of legislation and transparency and other aspects that might be of importance. We had a study, not the one that Bo referred to, but we had another study not long ago that had to do with aid of this kind to the public sector. And interestingly enough, that report gave the, you know, or suggested that we need to think more about what we had done in our own countries that had worked in terms of reforms, and perhaps drawn that lesson more when we were in other countries. Sweden had not been very good, he claimed, in using our own experience when we designed foreign aid. And I, just to end, I think that these two reports together give the impression that there is room for some sort of policy initiative in this area, trying to set up an institutional frame that would be more effective in challenging Swedish foreign aid and Swedish competence in some of these areas within our foreign aid system. Thank you. Thank you all of you for an interesting two and a half hours.